Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio.
Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
I had a brilliant roll call for Curtis Blow. But for some reason, y'all ain't never gonna know it.
Roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
My name is Sugar.
Yeah.
I love you all.
Yeah.
But once and for all.
Yeah.
Baseball.
Roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
Boss Bill's a roll call.
Yeah.
Coming off the cuff.
Yeah.
Rhyming words in English.
Yeah.
So why does it have to be so damn tough?
Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
It's La E.M.
Yeah.
With Curtis Blow.
Yeah.
If you're hip hop,
yeah,
you should already know.
Roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
One, two, three, four, hit it!
Yeah!
Now!
Yeah!
I'm gonna spit it!
Suprema! Suprema roll call!
We'll come back!
Suprema! Suprema roll call! Suprema! Suprema roll call! Suprema! Suprema roll call!
Alright, ladies and gentlemen. This is Questlove Supreme. I forgot the name of my own show. We are at iHeartRadio. Thank you very much. We're here with Team Supreme. Unpaid Bill.
And, not here.
Is not here. You are not Unpaid Bill. You are Boss Bill.
Wow.
I knew what I was saying. I knew. I was just testing to see if you knew who you were. Of course, we got Sugar Steve, and we have Laia with us. Unpaid Bill right now is doing his thing. And
Broadway.
Yeah. Yeah. whenever he's hit on Broadway, he don't have time for us no more. Ladies and gentlemen, plain and simple, you know, you hear of kings and pioneers and people bragging about their status in this culture. I assure you, ladies and gentlemen, that the gentleman that we're about to introduce is literally the pioneer of this amazing art form that has made trillions of dollars. What can I say? First rapper on a major label, first rapper to get a gold plaque, first rapper to cover a song, first rapper to make a love ballad, first rapper to tour overseas.
Wow.
I mean, his production credits loom large. I mean, for God's sakes, he produced the record that was Jay-Z's very first purchase of a full hip-hop album, speaking of the Fat Boys debut. I mean, through this man, like, this is how we know. He was the entry of Russell Simmons into the world, of Run into the world, of Full Force into the professional world, of Allison Williams, of the great unheralded Larry Smith and his production credits, the aforementioned Fat Boys, not to mention gave Salaam Remy his first start in production.
Oh,
yes.
My God, you know that?
A 14-year-old, yes. We do our homework. Not to mention what I credit as one of the rare legit hip hop movies about hip hop culture.
Yes.
This man is starred in as a political activist working with anti-apartheid Sun City Project. Not to mention organizing the King Celebrate holiday.
Yes.
I mean, so many credits. Oh Jesus, for a lot of us, our entry to Bob Dylan.
Right.
In hip-hop culture.
Hey.
Came to this dude. Yes, I'm pointing to the one and only. First rapper on Soul Train. You know Soul Train means everything to me.
Wow.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm so honored to have on Questlove Supreme, the one and only, Curtis. Blow to Questlove Supreme.
Thank you.
Man, this is a long time coming. We have a gazillion questions. This is like this show is such a it's nerd out culture going awry. So it's just bear with us if we ask too many nerdy questions.
That intro was so incredible. I mean, you kind of like had me shook there for a second. I didn't know I did so much stuff. I'm sitting here like, whoa,
yes, you did,
wait a
man.
Minute. I'm remembering things now.
We're literally about giving flowers where they're due.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, there's so much more that you're doing. I've been known to make like 15-minute intros and then it's time to go.
Grand opening, grand closing.
Right. So what I really, this is like one of our first chances to interview someone that was there for the beginning of hip hop culture before it came a professional business. Mm-hmm. So I have so many questions about its start and its formation in the Bronx, like the parties and all those things. Mm-hmm. Well, for those that don't know, that listen to us that are younger, where were you born?
I was born and raised in Harlem.
Okay, Harlem World.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
So could you give us kind of a prototypical idea of what the environment was when hip-hop was just a local block party thing, when it was just,
yes,
you know, like on a Saturday. Let's pick a Saturday in 1978, ooh, before it was a business.
Oh man!
What was?
You should probably go back before 78.
It's really amazing, and it's a story that, you know, the energy and the vibe and the spirit that was going around New York City, the five boroughs, during that time, was something that's so hard to explain. You really had to be there to really understand that energy that was happening. See, we were all like a group of people who understood and really related and loved this culture way before it became a culture. So it was just like something new that we were trying to do and represent. Of course, you had disco, mm-hmm, on this side of the fence, and then you had R&B soul music, and most of us grew up on soul music, and we loved James Brown and the Motown sound and the Isley Brothers and all of that stuff. And soul music, we started playing soul music when disco became the most prominent thing that you heard on the radio. But if you remember the Motown sound that we grew up on in the 60s, the snare drum, we're talking music theory now, mm-hmm, the snare drum was on the 1, 2, 3, and 4, pop, pop, pop. Right. Tap on baby, 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 mm-hmm, you know? And then disco comes out, and it went back to the same four on the floor
now. On the floor, right.
We're talking about the kick drum, right? The boom, 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 boom. So that beat for us wasn't like James Brown, because James Brown, in between disco and Motown, had a musical revolution, mm-hmm, with the sound that we call boom bap. So, mm-hmm, the boom, bap, boom, bap, boom, bap, bap, boom, bap.
Syncopated rhythms.
Yeah. And the drummer, you know, Clyde Stubblefield was incredible. So as kids, when we heard this new sound, we were like, we lost our minds. Everybody wanted to be James Brown and dance like him. And that's when we started going down to the floor whenever we heard the break. Because the break of the music was the most important part of the song. That's when everyone did their best dance moves. That's when we created the circle.
So people just literally wanted to wait for the breakdown. Like, okay.
That's what it was.
About 5 bars.
That's what it was.
It's really going to get crazy.
And I'm talking in 1972, 73.
Okay.
So here comes Kool Herc, the DJ, who understood this, that the break was so very important. And we were B-boys and B-girls because we danced to the breaks that Kool Herc would play. And he would play these funky, incredible songs like Give It Up or Turn It Loose, or Getting Into Something by the Isley Brothers, or Listen to Me by Baby Huey, or Jimmy Castor Has Just Begun, The Mexican, you know, The Melting Pot, Apache,
right,
you know, all these incredible songs. They were soul music, but they were fast. And it was the same kind of tempo as disco music. It was dance music. I call it obscure dance music. It was funk. Mm-hmm. And we just lost our minds. So we represented and created those circles around us, just like Saturday Night Fever, you know, the movie with John Travolta, mm-hmm, with the white suit on. He creates this circle around him, and pretty soon somebody comes in the circle and they do a competition and a battle, and the winner of that competition was the most popular guy. He was the hero of the story, right?
Right.
And so that's what happened at the Cool Herc clubs around 12, 1 o'clock in the morning. He played this Give It Up or Turn It Loose, and everybody was standing around waiting for the break. When that break came, we went off, and that was hip-hop, the first early days of hip-hop.
Now, for that particular record that you gave an example of, with Give It Up or Turn It Loose, which that particular recording was made in 1969. So even though James Brown himself was trying to keep up with the trends of the day and make disco records, you're basically saying that you guys never left those records alone. So a song like Get On the Good Foot still had life way beyond its 1972 release. Like, it still was something in 74, 75, 76, as long as it had a funk break. So did you guys look at the commercial music at the time as kind of like how we look at modern pop radio now? Like, man, I don't listen to that. I listen to...
No, it was cool. It was cool. It was all right. We listened to it. It was on the radio.
But it's nobody was breakdancing to like Stevie Wonder's I Wish.
No, it was more like, the village people. YMCA.
Oh, okay. So like the commercial disco stuff. Okay.
Donna Summer and stuff like that. Right. We were like, yo, we want James Brown. You know what I mean?
I see.
So hip hop became that rebellion to disco. I call it, ghetto disco.
Okay. For those that have been collecting tapes and really keeping up in the sort of the early formation of what hip hop was, the role the MC was once the co-star to who the DJ was. So
right.
Can you, what I want to know is, and I've heard like some of these like DJ Hollywood tapes.
Right.
Where in my mind, he had an endless vocabulary, an endless combination of rhymes that came up nowhere. Now, I mean, most MCs I know really have a good 15 to 20 minute repertoire before they run out of space and steam and, don't know what to do. But his things seem endless. Like, who in your mind were like the top five? First of all, who was the one, was Hollywood the pioneer of the call and response, rhyming, cadence,
right.
At least in the hip-hop sense. I know there's Jaco Henderson and all that stuff back in the day.
Yeah, of course.
But who was, in terms of hip-hop, was DJ Hollywood first? Like, where does Hollywood and Eddie Chiba and, like, all these other MCs that really weren't making records?
Okay, so after Herc, you have to see there were two different kinds of crowds.
Okay.
First and foremost, Flash, Grandmaster Flash calls them the shoe people and the sneaker people.
Oh, so there's now, bourgeois and okay.
The sneaker people, we partied at the block parties and the community centers and the park jams and the small around the way clubs, like 371 Disco Fever up in the Bronx and places like that. But, Grandmaster Flash was so very important to this transition. From the DJ being the focal point of the party. He controlled the music, he controlled the ambiance, he controlled the lights, he controlled the tempo of the songs he was playing.
He hired
and fired the MCs. The MCs were first a dime a dozen. All we did was we went to the house and we got the equipment and took the equipment to the gig and set it up.
Right.
And at the end of the night, we break it down and carry it back to the house. And the DJ would let us in free.
So that's your plus. That's your getting on the guest list.
and so if we were nice to him or if he was nice to us and feeling good, he would let us make announcements like, "Yo, Joey, your mom's outside. It's 10 o'clock. You got to go. Sam, your car's getting towed."
Right. Okay.
And so Flash, now Herc played a whole song.
Right.
He had the most incredible playlist, all the songs I named, and there are about 20, 25, 30 songs, maybe even 50, soul music in a club.
Right.
And so Flash understood that the most important part of this song that he played was the break, because he knew all the B-boys would go down to the floor and start doing their best moves. Everyone got crazy and started yelling and screaming, when the break came. And so he wanted to try to find a way to extend this break because the break was only 15, 20 seconds long. Mm-hmm. And so he got two copies of the same record, and he started playing the break. Herc would play a whole song, and right. you have to stand up waiting for the break to come, right?
Oh,
Flash went there. He just started the break at the top of the song, you know, and he'd play the break. And when it got to the end of the break, before the singing started coming back in, he'd play the beginning of the break again. So he actually extended this break and made it from 15, 20 seconds to 3-4 minutes.
Right.
Right? So we had to do more as MCs than make announcements.
So I have a question. At the time, what was the transition? Because are people, they not, are we scratching yet?
Right. He started scratching. And,
Flash? Okay.
You know, he was very, very fast because you had to go from one turntable to the other to catch the beat before it ended and got to the whack part.
Right.
Right. And so he extended the break. And
shout
gave
out to
us,
Theodore, too.
Right.
Okay. Theodore listens to the show. He'll get mad. Yes, Theodore, we know you invented the scratch.
Okay, that's what I was
Grand
okay.
Wizard Theodore. Yes.
Grand Wizard, yes, we love you. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it was like DJs like that that gave us the opportunity to shine. So we became like, instead of standing on the side of the turntables just making announcements, we went out front.
Okay.
And started rocking the crowd, and we had to do more. So we started telling stories and rapping in rhythm and, you know, using crowd response, throw your hands in the air and all of that stuff. And that's how, you know, it really came off. So Hollywood, get into Hollywood, he was a master at the crowd response. And he had a Puerto Rican DJ by the name of DJ Junebug. Rest in peace, the best DJ I ever saw in my life. Very fast, accurate. Would keep the beat going for Hollywood, and he was just tearing it up. When I saw Hollywood at this club 371, it blew my mind. I never knew that there was something like this possible,
right.
You know, that a guy could just take control of an audience and have them eating out of the palm of his hands just by the way that he was rapping in rhythm. First time I ever heard rhythmic rap was DJ Hollywood. You know, of course, there were other MCs before him, like KC, the Prince of Soul, JJ, the Disco King. You had Up in the Bronx with Herc. You had Coke LaRock. He was the first MC up in the Bronx, rocking, just talking smack on the microphone.
Right. Okay.
You know, but Hollywood put it together with rhythmic chants, like throw your hands in the air and wave them like you just don't care. And if you got on clean underwear, somebody say, oh yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. You know, everybody, you got to say, oh, yeah. You know?
I got on clean underwear. No, I don't. I'm commando, so.
Oh, I didn't need to know that.
Hey,
I'm playing.
Right now.
Yeah, Mama, I got clean underwear.
So, it's... Was that a eureka moment for you? Like,
it was a eureka moment. You know, just seeing Herc. The first time I saw Herc, it blew my mind. Just the fact that he had this big, huge, humongous sound system. And he was playing these songs that I grew up with that I just thought that, you know, Give It Up or Turn It Loose was my favorite song. And he played it loud and everyone went crazy. And then you had Grandmaster Flash was another one, blew my mind with the speed on the turntables. Right. And this guy had white gloves on with rings on and they were just flashing. He's going to turn. I saw him at the Hotel Diplomat one time, and that was just amazing to see how fast he was and keeping that beat going. And it's real what we call turntablism,
right.
This evolution of the turntable, the DJs. And Flash gave us the opportunity, along with Hollywood. Everyone mimicked Hollywood when he came out. He blew my mind as well.
Did you guys ever venture out of the boroughs? So was there a thing of like... You know, was touring for you back then like, okay, I'm going to do a party in Queens, or would Long Island be a part of this folklore as well? Staten Island even, like...
Newark.
Or was it just... Or even Newark. Like, or did boroughs just, like, stick to themselves until rap became a business?
Well, me, I was a traveler. I went from Harlem, you know, at 14 years old, 15 years old, traveling that number 4 train, riding up to the Bronx, you know, to check out Kool Herc at the Executive Playhouse. And it was scary. You know, that was during the time when Roots had came out, where Alex Haley's Roots.
Right.
And so there was a lot of that, you know, right straight out of the civil rights movement, and cats were like feeling themselves. And there was a lot of violence on that train. You know what I mean? A lot of people
So you
were
risked
getting,
everything just to see.
Man.
It was worth it. That's what I want to know. What makes, that's the one thing I didn't have. Like, I had strict parents
right.
that were just like, No, you ain't going. So whenever I hear like the generation after you talk about the Latin Quarter.
Right, right.
And I'm like, yo, y'all could have, y'all risking y'all lives to hear this. Like, you might get stabbed, shot, killed, or hurt. Oh, so
no, but, no. Hey, but understand, you know, understand. You know, you know. There were so many things going around in the community in New York City that was happening during that time. And I'm telling you, hip hop was like a savior. You know, like you know, we had the gangs. Mm-hmm. The gangs, like that movie, The Warriors, was real. There were a lot of gangs. I remember running home from school, you know, in the early 70s, because all you had to do is say, they coming, and we out. You know what really? I mean? You know, going to the corner store for my mom. It's like, yo, you want me to go to the store?
Risk you know, your life. Okay, I'm glad to know I'm not the only one that goes through
crazy.
That.
Crazy. And then you had
for toilet paper, and then you had to map out.
You had the drug wars of the Bronx and Harlem coming out of the Frank Lucas story, mm-hmm. American mm-hmm. Gangster.
Right.
You know, when he went to jail, and I think it was 1974, 75, they had a big drug war. Everybody was fighting for his territory. So there were a lot of murders and gunshots and all around. People were just dropping like flies. You know, so it was kind of dangerous. It was dangerous living during that time. So for me, you know, it was my savior. I used to love to go to the club and just, you know, go to the speaker and stick my head in the speaker, and the bass was rumbling all the way through my toes, and I just closed
my eyes. So all that was worth it.
I closed my eyes and go off, and that's hip hop.
He just told the story of the first time I ever went to a club. Like,
everyone has that experience.
Yeah. You put your head in the speaker and it just changes your life.
Yeah.
Yep.
What do you think hip hop culture would have been if there was no blackout of 1977?
A lot of cats talk about that because a lot of equipment
right.
was obtained
right.
during those years, during that blackout 1977.
Right.
But for me, it was more like, you know, we hit the local bike store and I got like 3 bikes.
So you wanted to travel. See, you're a traveler. See? I told you he's a pioneer.
He didn't want to be on that train.
Yeah. He's a pioneer.
No more Fortran.
That's a long ride, though, to the Bronx.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. But, you know, just traveling around New York City was special for me. I just thought that, you know, I had cousins out in Queens and 40 Projects and Cambria and aunts and uncles all around Queens. So, you know, I used to spend my summers out in Queens, actually. You know how we all used to go south. Where you
down
going?
South,
to?
Right.
No, I'm going to Atlanta. Where you going? I'm going to North Carolina. Where you going, Kim and Kurt? We're going to Queens.
Me too.
So, but it's like another world, probably.
You know, and it's suburbia.
Suburbia, that's what I was going to say. Really, Jamaica. I used to get sent out to Jamaica.
Oh, that part of Queens.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so just spending my days out there whenever I could, you know, having a lot of family out in Queens, I hung out with Russell Simmons because I met him in college, and okay. He was from Hollis, Queens, and we opened up a club in 1978 called Disco Fever. I mean, Night Fever Disco.
Whew. Okay, okay. I was like, wait, you were part of that? Okay.
And you opened up a club?
And that was 201st Street in Hollis Avenue, and that's where I really got good as a DJ, you know, DJing in the club and for a year. And then we actually used propaganda, and Russell started putting my name on flyers. Queens number one DJ, Curtis Blow.
Oh, okay. So he built the folklore of Curtis Blow, and that's
right.
How
Russell was a sociology major, you know, so he understood about the masses and the spectrum and the different movements of people and what they would like and stuff like that. So he convinced me to let that propaganda happen.
So is he the one that talked you into, would you say that your entry into hip hop is what really put the focus on the MC as opposed to the DJ?
No, because I think Hollywood did that. He was actually the first king of rap. He was okay. So hot. He was the first guy that charged $500. Before that, we were making $30, $40 a night, MCs. Or, you know, the popular ones were getting $100, $150 a night. but Hollywood was the first to charge $500. You want $500?
But Hollywood at your party meant a guaranteed show, you know.
Oh, yeah, it was packed. You have a line around the corner, you know. And so cats started, you know, trying to charge $500. And they were like, shit, nigga, you ain't Hollywood.
So I guess technically your first single was Christmas Rapping, correct?
Yes, 1979.
Okay, so please, how did that come about? And how did you avoid Sylvia Robinson and Joey and also Bobby Robinson at Enjoy? There's no relationship between the two, right? Like, they just both coincidentally have a name.
Right.
Robinson. So Enjoy, right, right. Bobby Robinson and Sylvia Robinson were not related, correct?
Yeah, Bobby Robinson was from Harlem. He had that store on 125th Street.
Okay.
Bobby's Records, you know. Okay. And he goes back to the 40s and 50s.
Yeah.
You know, he has a lot of contacts. Everybody knows him in soul music and R&B music.
Okay.
And so, you know, during that time, of course, Sugar Hill Gang, when they came out, well, let's give a shout out to King Tim III. That was actually the first
My bad.
Personality jock.
Then you stomp your feet cause you listen to the sound of the shimps you need. I'm the K-I-N-G, the T-I-M, King Tim the Third, and I am him.
And so here comes Sugar Hill. Every bus, every car, every train wanted to play that Rapper's Delight song.
Mm-hmm.
I said a hip hop, the hip hop, you don't stop the rocket.
Every taxi, every boombox, every record store was playing it 24/7. And so we were in the studio in October, and so we were trying to get a record deal. I think I got my record deal because Rapper's Delight was so hot. We went to 22 different labels, though.
Yikes.
And everybody hated the record except for two people. The first guy liked it. He wanted to sign me up. So he took it up the flagpole to the vice president and president, and they said no. So
what label was that?
That was the guy's name was Corey Robbins.
Okay.
Now, Corey quit his job because of this, and he went and started his own label. And 2 years later, he signed Run DMC, and the label is called Profile Records,
okay.
Right? So the next guy is an English fellow, John Staines. He's A&R director for Mercury Polygram Records over in the UK, in London. He said, we can recoup this record in 6 months. Let's sign him up. So
actually,
I became a British artist.
Really?
Signed to a company called Mercury Phonogram out in the UK, and my records came back to America on an import.
Wow.
Crazy deal.
So they had you first, and they knew you first.
Yeah, so I was the first artist signed to a major label.
So can I assume that your A&R was the person that said,
"Twas the night before Christmas."
Before you interrupted him with,
"Hold it now, wait."
Hold it now, wait. Was he the "Twas the night"?
That's him.
How did you guess that, Amir? Is that like always the situation?
No, I just put two and two together. The guy was English, and you know, and a lot of the earlier records is really weird, especially with your catalog. A lot of your catalog, and I hope I'm not opening up Well, hopefully the grace period is over. even as I was recapping your catalog, I didn't realize how much, in particular, the Bomb Squad, when Public Enemy was making Nation of Millions,
right,
used a lot of your records as the basis for their rhythms.
Right.
I just found out today that from the back Popular Demand album,
right,
one of those songs is the basis for the Night of Living Bassheads remix, which is weird. They could have just sampled James Brown, but instead they were like, all right, let's sample, it's meta, like let's sample Curtis Blow sampling James Brown with the extra kicks in there and all that stuff. So anyway, I'm falling in a rabbit hole. But my point is, you were one of the very first rappers to travel overseas. So what is that like, literally being the Trojan horse or the Neil Armstrong or the flagship.
Guinea pig.
I don't want to say Christopher Columbus because I don't believe him. But I'm just saying.
He didn't stop
on Columbus Day.
Right, exactly. Like,
just an Italian.
To be the flag bearer of, like, was there resistance? Was there, or did you find that in Europe, like, they were really more open? Because you also did Top of the Pops, right?
Right, yes.
What was that like?
Man, it's like a dream world. You know, I tell people this many a times that my life is like a dream world. It's hard to understand reality mm-hmm. when you're, you know, in the right place at the right time. And, you know, big shout out to Debbie Harry, who actually flew me out to the UK for a big press conference. And, you know, being on a major label, that means, you know, major press, that means we have a major office in every major city around the world. And being a college student, you know, I wanted to work the system. And so I went to the publicity department. I said, man, send me everywhere. I want to travel all over,
right?
You know. And when I got there, I sat up in the conference room and we had all the press, you know, lined up from print magazines, newspapers, radio, television. It was incredible and awesome to just be a part of all of that stuff. And it was documented, you know, this new thing called hip hop. And I was representing this. So
was it tiring, like trying to explain to people
no.
what this was?
Or, no.
You know,
no.
the history of it. And
No. Being a communications major.
I was gonna ask what your major was.
Yeah. I love to talk.
Right. Okay.
And then it was so very, very important. Like you said, you know, we had to actually, you know, be good on stage.
Right.
You know, because that was very, very important to the success of the culture. When people see you live on stage. And during that time, if you didn't have a good show, people the next day would not go out and buy your record.
Right.
That's how, you know, the music business operated. You know, you go out on tour and you sing your new song, your new album, and then the next day everyone goes and buys the record. This is how they support it.
Mm-hmm.
And so going out there on stage for the first times and seeing these audiences and the audiences seeing me for the first time or seeing hip hop for the first time, a lot of that, you know, where's your band?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but at the end of the show, they're all saying, oh, you know, and it was so very important for us to rock the house. And that was key to, you know, my experience in being in New York City, around the five boroughs, just, you know, playing the clubs and, you know, like the Night Fever Disco and the Hotel Diplomat 371 Disco Fever, you know, the block parties and the park jams, just being used to handling a microphone and mic control. MC means mic control. And it was so very important. I just thank God that I had that experience. 7-8 years in the biz before I made my first record.
So in touring behind the single, especially mainstream, I'm assuming that you did tours with regular acts and whatnot.
Yeah.
Okay, so I know now, I mean, especially with, I mean, even in modern times, like watching the Wu-Tang series that's on TV right now,
uh-huh.
and it's to the point now where, at least of this recording, where like the RZA is starting the tour and what I call like rapper problems, like with the monitors not working and
yeah.
the proper channels for the DJ and the, you know, all those things and the mics not working. Like, how difficult was it as far as like opening, first of all, like what mainstream bands were you touring with
mm-hmm.
back during this period? Like, who were you opening for in America at least?
Okay. People like Kool and the Gang and the Gap Band and Confunction. I remember going on tour
uh-huh.
in 1980, the All Platinum Tour with the Commodores. The Commodores were really, really hot. Lionel Richie had
right.
all those ballads and stuff. And uh-huh. wow, we did about 120 shows around the country. And they took me places I never heard of before, like Tupelo, Mississippi, you know. And a lot of college towns. It was incredible just being a part of that tour and meeting people. And for me, it was like, you know, I had this thing. It became a mission of mine to meet my heroes that I grew up. All those soul singers
right.
that I listened to as a kid. I just wanted to meet them and hug them. And so I had, again, my record company set it up, the publicity department, Beverly Page. She okay. set it up with people like, I met Aretha Franklin.
Really?
Over, and she invited me for lunch over at Hitsville Studio, and we sat and talked for an hour, and you know, this
is... talk about her rapping son?
Oh, yes.
I'm sorry. Like, if you have any dealings, if you're in the hip hop nation and you have any dealings with Aretha Franklin, trust me, her son's name's going to come up. Trust me, I know.
Alf?
Yeah.
My sister went to high school with him.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
He's still looking for a deal right now.
So wait, how earlier on was the Aretha meeting? Because I'm wondering, I'm like, how did she know that she needed to have a conversation?
It's like 1981 or
you gotta understand, like he was a star out the gate.
I understand like, that, but for Aretha Franklin to understand that is a whole nother level.
No, I mean, like especially with roller skating culture, like really hitting its zenith in like 19, like the breaks to me, that song was tailor-made for roller skating culture. Like between 78
boom
and 83, at least, roller skating culture. So it was like, I feel as though that's roller skating culture is what allowed boogie music. Like the breaks wasn't a disco song, so it wasn't like, but it still had a groove to it that was like disco, but slower.
Right.
So, and it made it easier to navigate on skates.
Yeah, all levels.
And so, yeah, they're like, I don't recall, like we went roller skating every Sunday in the summer of 1980, and the breaks had to have been played five, six times, like without, between like Curtis Blow and Rick James, like it was like the battle of who owned roller skates. So how important are relationships? Because I also know that it's kind of weird. I'm a Soul Train expert. So here's the thing about your particular episode. So when Don's talking to you, and this is something that he's known for every episode, he kind of lets in a snarky thing like, I'm an old guy, I don't understand, but you know, the kids love it, I don't get it, but whatever. But I mean, at least the resistance. How much resistance did you have to go, not only to get your record deal, but like, what was it just like for people not to see the future? Because people hate change more than anything.
Well,
even if it's good for them.
There's a story behind that. You know, again, it's 1980.
Right.
And I was just coming off a tour in Europe.
Okay.
I think I did about 30 shows in 33 days or something. Oof. Monumental tour. But during that time, Milli Vanilli over in Europe was the hottest thing on the press, with the press.
Right.
Everyone was talking about them and their show, their live show, their lip singing.
Okay.
Right? And it was like the record company came to me, the promoters came to me, oh, you can't lip sing, make sure you don't lip sing. I'm telling you, they're going to boo you and this and that. We don't play that over here in Europe, and you got to do an hour and a half, you know.
Ooh, and have a real show.
And, right? And so I'm like, okay, no problem. And you know, I'm made for that because I have on every song, most every song about the first 10 singles, I have the B-side has an instrumental and I rap live.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we call it half playback. So I got through the tour. But when I came back to America and I'm setting up for Soul Train, I'm sitting in the makeup room and Irene Cara is sitting right there. And at the forefront of my mind, I'm thinking about, you know, Milli Vanilli and what's going on there. And I know that, you know, they lip sync on Soul Train. That's their policy.
Yeah.
So here comes Don Courtney. Oh, well, the stage manager comes in with the microphone. The microphone's got this phony little plug.
Right.
Right. It's all right, you got to lip sing and make sure you word the words, you know, you mouth the words just like the song and be in rhythm and stuff.
They didn't
stuff
do camera
like
blocking back then?
I'm like, look.
We're weird, right?
I am not going to lip sing. Uh-uh. That's not what I do. This is hip hop. We do hip hop here. This is live. And plus I got crowd response. I need to say these words, the crowd response, and have the whole audience answer back to me. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's very important. This is hip hop. I'm not lip singing.
Right.
And they were like, oh, Don Cornelius came in. What do you mean you're not going to lip sing? This is our rules. This is our policy. Well, look, Mr. Cornelius, I'm going home. How about that one? Irene Cara looked at me like, boy, you crazy. Right? And so,
because isn't it everyone's dream to be on Soul Train? Like,
yes. And it was a big thing. But I did not want to get the Europeans and America hasn't, you know, gotten this news yet about Milli Vanilli yet.
Right. Well, you know, you're predating it.
And
but you mean just with lip singing and stuff?
I didn't want to have that that reputation.
Right.
You
okay.
know? So I was the first artist to sing live.
Right.
The breaks on Soul Train. So that's why Don comes out with that snorky. Oh, I don't know what everybody's making so much a big fuss about this
Oh,
thing.
Is that what he said?
Yeah. It was a little snarky. It wasn't like...
And I was shocked because I looked at him like...
Nigga, no, you didn't.
Right.
So by this point, was Run your DJ on this initial run?
Yes. Yes.
He was.
Yeah. Oh, but no. After that, before the Commodores tour, here's a story about Run. Run was my DJ before the Commodores tour,
okay.
that all platinum tour. So Run was out playing basketball with this guy down the block named Jason Mizell,
mm-hmm.
right? So he breaks his arm playing basketball. And so I'm like, yo, we got to go on tour, man. I was asking his dad. His dad's, no, you can't go out on tour. Please, Dad, let me go. He said, no, you got to stay in school. He said, no, please, Dad, let me go on tour. Look, you got one arm. You can't DJ. Yes, I can. Look, bam, bam, bam.
Right.
Right? And so he didn't get to go, and he stayed home. So when I got back off a tour about 4 months later, that's when I heard that he started a group. Called Run DMC with his fellas that were up in the attic practicing and hanging out with him. And so the story is, if Run didn't break his arm, there would be no Run DMC.
Wow. He'd be your DJ.
He would just been your DJ.
Yeah.
Can I ask
and a- Russell didn't have enough pull to be like, Dad, I'll take care of him? Like, was Russell also traveling with you at the...
Nah, Dad was running the show. Yeah. Dad was very powerful. He bought Run the turntables.
Okay.
Because it's three brothers, right? Like Danny, Russell, and Run.
Right.
And
exactly.
Who's the oldest? Because I was getting confused with Danny.
The oldest.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I was wondering.
Russell's the middle child, and Joey is the youngest.
Can I ask you
Russell's
a question
the
about
middle? That makes that explains so much.
What? It does.
Russell's the middle child.
Oh yeah, you gotta make yourself distinct.
Yeah.
What was your question
about touring? Because I know since you were the first to ever tour like this internationally, there had to be mm-hmm. like some mistakes. There had to be like some moments where you and Russell were like, okay, so we're not going to do this like that again. Like, there were just so many new things to you guys. Like, did you even know about writers? Did you know, like, what didn't you know that you learned in your first?
How many lost passports?
Yeah.
I had to learn it all. I learned it all on
Where's your traveling entourage like
the
back
fly.
Then?
Oh, it was incredible. I was the most sought after live act. Because it was just me and my DJ.
Just two people?
Two people. Two turntables and a microphone.
Really?
Yes.
So not the first to start the entourage.
Right.
Right. That's the
so
only one.
So you were easy to work with.
But then Russell in 81.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So here he comes with Larry Smith. Larry Smith was playing bass.
Right.
Played bass on the breaks and Christmas rap and...
So Larry Smith produced Orange Crush was the band for all those for Christmas rap.
No, not Orange Crush. That came after.
Okay.
Russell took $40,000 of my money and bought all his band. You know, he gave it to Larry. Larry bought the band equipment, and they said, "All right, you're going out with a band." I'm like, "What? Yeah. How could you do that? I didn't okay this." He said, "Wait, hey." I'm the manager.
So you built Larry Smith's career.
Well,
you provided the
budget
that got him all the equipment.
No,
the
Larry, money. I got to give props to him because he was
excellent. He was a genius. Yeah.
Excellent musician, incredible producer.
Right.
You know, I remember many of the nights we sat up and talked about, you know, my sound and trying to get a sound that was in between James Brown and Chic.
Right.
And Larry was the man. He was definitely the man. I love him.
So who
Rest
worked on,
peace.
Like, Christmas Rapping and Rapping Blow and...
Yeah, that was Larry. Larry was on the bass.
Okay.
But you had John Trope.
Okay.
Was on guitar. And we had Jimmy Breilau, who actually went on to become a Lindrum...
Consultant and...
A Lindrum programmer.
Okay.
And he was on drums and... You know, so during that time, you know, we recorded in the studio like the 70s. In the 60s, it was a live band.
Right.
You know what I mean? And we had to rehearse and, you know, oh, let's play it one more time and record it, and hopefully it would come out okay.
I'm sorry.
And we do
white,
rough.
My white guy in the corner has a question.
Yes.
So John Tropia.
Yeah.
The guitarist.
Yes.
So was he the guitar? He's a, to me, he's a famous jazz guitarist.
Right, right.
And I
he's on the Breaks.
Wow.
That's his work?
That's his,
holy shit,
his work. That guitar on the Breaks.
Is he on,
school me on him,
is he on Run DMC's stuff?
No, that was Eddie Sancho. Well, Eddie Sancho did Martinez. Rock Bucks. Okay. Eddie Martinez
Eddie
did
Martinez.
Rock Bucks.
Wow. No, I need to process. I'm not schooling you on anything. Yeah. I don't know too much about him. I have a few records.
You know his name. Okay.
Yeah, Steve don't get blown away easily, but it is Curtis Blow.
No, that's just weird.
Unexpected. No, it was an unexpected name, yeah.
Yeah, but he's a legend, definitely a legend. And, you know, I remember seeing him in the studio because my producer, J.B. Moore, was also a guitar player, and he couldn't do the guitars right the way we wanted it. And the way he wanted it, actually. And so when John came in and played it,
perfect rhythm.
And it was just immaculate, you know.
Guitar drives the tone.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So for your first album, like, whose idea was it to do, like, taking care of business and to do
all the girls? And what's the other one? The slow one that's like,
All I want in this world to find that girl.
Yes.
Yeah, people don't even credit that as the first love ballad. So it's like, for you, you were making a format that was palatable to radio. Was like Frankie Crocker on your mind? Like, okay.
Or was it the label saying we need something that, you know.
Right. Well, it was all by design, of course. You know, we wanted to, you know, have a fusion with other forms of music because it was so brand new, this thing, hip-hop and rap, you know. So why not rap over a rock and roll song? Why not have a reggae rap? Or I was the first to do a country and western rap.
Way Out West.
That Way Out West song, you know. You know, we just tried to be different and tried to give something new.
The sky was the limit, man.
Philly.
In retrospect, though, do you see how, like, free you were in that moment? Because I feel like a lot of MCs today, out the gate, couldn't just say, I'm a producer and this different genre. They won't be allowed to.
Well, here's the thing. I always wanted to be a singer. And I remember singing those singing songs that every album I put on the singing
Adrian
song.
Yeah, all those joints.
But listen, folks, it took me a couple of weeks to do those vocals. I can't lie.
I hear you.
It's party time. Oh, it's party time.
So in 83, in Philadelphia, Party Time, very big record.
Oh, yes.
Which, of course, you know, Laia would know that.
Tracy Lee?
Tracy Lee.
Hey, like, Trey, yeah.
Like, try to bring that back. So that was the first time I ever heard Full Force on record. Wow. So how did you hook up with those guys as far as, like, did they produce that record or were they just a band or, like, how did you guys?
No, they became producers after that because we sat in the studio and talked about, you know, J.B. Moore and Robert Ford and what they were doing on my stuff and how they wanted to do the same thing but differently, more funkier or more creative. So they were incredible. I met them through J.B. Moore and Robert Ford, and very, very, very talented musicians and singers. And it was incredible just to be a part of that. But the Go Go song,
talk about it, Trouble Funk,
wow,
or the
Trouble
EU.
Funk, okay. That was EU.
EU.
Right. Mm-hmm. So here it is on my birthday. I turned 21 years old.
Uh-huh.
I had the number one record in the country, and so I'm going down to play the Capitol Center down in D.C. Right. So I had my band, remember the Orange Crush band? I got timbales and, oh man, we got like eight, nine pieces, right?
Right.
We rolled down to the Capitol Center. And I'm headlining this concert, and they have all these local bands there. And I didn't know what they were, you know, what it was. So
uh-oh.
I walk in the spot, I'm hearing.
First time hearing Go Go?
First time I'm hearing Go Go.
Yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah. The whole crowd is going crazy. I'm saying, oh, I'm about to tear this place up. Right?
Yes.
So they were going crazy, and it was a band called Trouble Funk. Then another band came on, EU Freeze, right? They went on and same thing. And the crowd is going crazy again, even more crazy. So I'm like, wow, Chuck Brown was there.
Oh, my God, yes.
Right, the Godfather. He comes out and tears up the spot, too. So it's my turn. So I go out there.
I don't like where you're taking the story. Let me cue this music up. So go ahead.
I throw on Christmas rapping. We playing Christmas rapping. The band is tight, clean, and everything. But the crowd is like this, looking at us like. I'm like, oh my gosh, I mean, we better get to the breaks and, you know, quick on this one here, right?
Right.
So I'm speeding through the set and then we throw on the brakes. Clap your hands, everywhere.
Right?
Yeah. And then like,
no. Wow.
Still, right? Number one record in country. And so that night I got my butt tore up 3 or 4 different times. And for me, it was like, my mom's always said, if you can't beat them, join them.
Mm. Hell yeah.
So I got all their numbers.
Okay, nice.
Next year, I called my boy Sugar Bear.
Yeah.
And so that's Sugar Bear and them playing on Party Time?
We did Party Time.
Oh, damn. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
And it's just wonderful to have them in the studio just doing that thing live.
And how many pieces incredible. In the studio in that moment?
It was like 7-8 pieces. Yeah.
And so you were the first for that, too, I'm guessing. The first to do a go-go collab.
Well, no. Because Flash and them did a live version. Well, they actually signed Trouble Funk to Sugar Hill Records.
Right.
The first live go-go that I've heard was Trouble Funk Live on Sugar Hill. So the Robinsons got there early on that.
And then the first sample loop, right?
Mm-hmm.
Was on the song If I Rule the World. And the sample was Trouble Funk. You know that pump it up.
That was your...
I took the percussion part. And laid it under If I Rule the World.
Okay. How did that feel for you? To have that song come back and for people to learn that you're the origin of that particular song, because that song means so much to.
I like your harmonies,
Nas
the best
fans,
though.
And
he got better harmonies.
Okay, well,
I'm just saying.
Well, throw for Lauren me, in the trash it was.
I'm just saying that song right there, no, Curtis. You know, you top Lauren.
It was just
that was you and Allison Williams actually.
Right,
that's Allison singing. Yeah,
yes,
too, right.
Yes.
Fonda Rae was on that?
Yeah.
Fonda Rae.
I know that name.
You had the heavy hitters.
And Audrey Wheeler. Yes.
You had the heavy hitters.
Wow.
Yes.
And see, so, I knew the harmonies were better.
it was awesome. It's the ultimate in flattery to hear your song on the radio that you recorded some time ago. I remember when Sony sent me the tape, they sent me a cassette tape, and it was awesome. I sat there and played the tape in my car.
Right.
For about 3 hours, kept rewinding it, you know, and it was like, oh my God, that's gotta be Lauryn Hill. That's gotta be Lauryn Hill, you know. So I called them back. I said, look, Sony, you guys got a big, major, major monster hit on you. You better put all your promotion in this, because this is going platinum. It went triple platinum.
Yeah.
Now, did you think that were too close or?
Same thing.
You
same
it,
thing.
You heard it, you was
but
like.
But I didn't hear it. I didn't hear that song like. Like I sat and, you know, listened to If I Rule the World.
Because I feel like the checks are the same. Like that song gets played more than If I Rule the World, right?
Yeah.
Talk about Next Too Close,
it
y'all.
Was hit. It was huge. It won Song of the Year, I think, in 90-something.
Jesus Christ, I forgot about Next.
Baby, when we're crying, that's right. I get so excited.
That's all, like, the song that you get annoyed because it just played all the time.
No,
that's,
hey, that's that keeps the dance floor, you know, as a DJ, I need that song, so I get it. I know I don't want to skip 84, and I know that your involvement in the King Celebration thing was important. Can you tell the story? I've heard the story about you personally, like Prince funding this.
Is this Sing Celebrate? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, okay. King.
Yes.
So how did the idea come to be?
Well, I got a phone call from Dexter Scott King, Martin Luther King's son.
The fine one.
And it was incredible.
Is he the only one?
No, so they all left.
Okay. Here he goes, hello, Curtis. This is Dexter Scott King, and I'm the son of Martin Luther King, and
he sounds like
I want you to produce a song about my father. So no, I hung up on him.
Bam. You thought it was a prank?
Right? I thought it was a prank. He called me back. I hung up on him again. So the third time I listened to him, I was like, well, he's got to be real. He's calling three times.
Right.
So we got together, became good friends. So another guy, Philip Jones, who was the other producer on the set. And I went to back to Mercury, Polygram, mm-hmm. and convinced them to sponsor this song. And they paid for the studio. And I called all the artists. It was no one said no. Mm-hmm. So the idea was to use all the people that weren't in We Are the World. Right?
Yeah.
And so, yes.
Whitney, including an unknown Whitney Houston.
Whitney said yes.
Right.
And Stephanie Mills said yes. Menudo with Ricky Martin.
Ricky Martin.
Yeah.
It was incredible.
Can you give us one note? Who was the one artist that was like, I'll make it, and then didn't?
No, everyone said yes. It was incredible. It was such a meaningful song, mm-hmm. you know, to be a part of that. And it was a lot of fun to make, you know.
So what
and
was then, Princeton's?
So the record company did not want to pay for the video, the music video.
Okay.
So Dex went and got with Prince, and asked Prince, would he pay for it? And he calls me up and said, Prince said he's going to put up $90,000 for this music video, and I was like, oh my gosh, yes it did, and Prince and I became friends after that. I mean, he was really, really a nice guy.
Involvement with Crush Groove. I forgot.
Right. And you know me, I'm trying to, you know, hang out with all the stars that I could. And so I went back to my record company. I said, hook up something for me and Prince. We got to do something together. So they did. Beverly Page, she hooked up this picture autograph session with me and Prince. We were in Detroit somewhere. And the club was packed. There's a line outside of all these women. Right?
Of course.
And so Prince signs about 1,500 autographs and takes about 1,500 pictures. And me, I took about 10 pictures.
Really?
He was a big, huge superstar. People loved him, man. What a great guy.
Wow.
Yep, yep.
So uncharacteristic of him.
Yeah.
You never know. Working on the Crush Groove movie.
Yes.
Well, obviously, you know, we know that's based on the life of Russell Simmons, but how was that experience for you in general?
Well, it was a lot of hard work, I'll tell you the truth, because during that time I was a producer,
mm-hmm.
and so I was producing the Fat Boys' second album and producing my America album with If I Rule the World on
right,
it,
yeah.
and also the Crush Groove soundtrack. So I was producing three albums at one time and had deadlines and all that. So I was going to three different studios every day, you know, and it was hard work. And then I had to wake up at 6 a.m. to get on film set, you know, to do the movie. And it was a lot of work. As a matter of fact, I kind of like took a break. You know, the last thing I did was a Martin Luther King song. And then I took a break for about 5 years. Didn't go into the studio, couldn't go into the
too
studio.
Too much working.
It was too much.
Because you didn't produce the third Fat Boys record.
No.
What was it like just, were you managing them at the time or just producing them?
Their manager was a guy by the name of Charlie Stettler.
Disco Fever?
Right, right. And he also manages Scribbles, DJ Scribbles. And,
okay.
And Dr. Dre and Ed Lover from Yo MTV Raps.
Right.
But Charlie was their manager. And they were signed to Sutra Records.
Right.
And Morris Levy. It was.
Wait, Morris Levy owned Sutra?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
A Levy, Steve.
Yo, that explains a lot. I thought after Roulette Records and the Hitman book, I thought Morris Levy just left the business.
What did Morris Levy do?
Dog, you just got to read Hitman, like.
The title is not good.
It's, his book is Hitman, you know.
Yeah.
Right, right.
Morris Levy owned Sutra?
But they were some good guys. I mean, you know, from Brooklyn.
Well, good fellas.
And, no, the Fat Boys. You know.
Oh, those guys. Yeah, yeah. Okay. I thought you meant Morris Levy. I'm like, wait a minute, man. Jesus Christ. Yeah, yeah, like, for me, that album managed, you captured their humorous spirit in a way that, you know, hip-hop hadn't seen before.
Right.
And especially that first record. Like, that, I think everyone that's of my age now, like, that was their first experience, either that or the Run DMC record.
Right.
But, yeah, just producing. I mean, how hard was it trying to explain, like, they don't need music and just beep the culture beatboxing? And how did you manage? How many takes would it take to get, like, those songs perfected?
They were great in the studio. It was awesome. What is on the record, that humor, that genuine personality comes through, mm-hmm. because I just, you know, let the record button go. And I remember Buff, rest in peace, he said one time, he said, yo, Kurt, man, yo, all I want is a car. He got two houses and all of this stuff, man. And these guys were incredible. And they love music. I found out as a producer, the basic job of a producer is to make people's dreams come true. You know, you take them around the bases and bring them home. And when you get home, you know, you have that finished product. And that's our job.
Well, how weird was it letting a 14-year-old produce you? Because Salaam Remy got his start as a 14-year-old kid.
Well, like, he had the tracks.
Okay.
You know, and I wanted to give him a shot. His dad was a very good friend. He worked at the record company. He was one of the promoters, mm-hmm. Promotion department. He actually introduced me to his son and said, you know, he's got some good stuff. And I said, well, I'll give him a shot. How about that? You know? So he did the Back by Popular Demand song.
Yeah.
You know, and that was great. He actually asked Molly Marr to do the scratches on it. And Molly came down to the studio.
Really?
Because of this kid.
Oh, wow.
And got on the record and started scratching. And, wow, the rest is history.
That's crazy. So at the end of the day, what do you want your legacy to be as far as your... I mean, you've done so many things to be first at this and first at that. Like, where do you see the history of hip hop as far as like preserving it and mm-hmm. those types of things? Like, how do you want to see the culture preserved?
Well, I'm working.
Not, what do you think of rap today? Which I hate when I get asked that question.
Well, but, you know, there's a project we're working on called the Universal Hip Hop Museum, where we want to document this history and put it in a brick-and-mortar location where the whole world can come and visit and see and be a part of it. And just, you know, the many stories, the many lives, and the many careers and the so much talent that has been a part of this way of life that it needs to be documented. It needs to be stored and cherished and supported in one place, and we're doing that, working on that right now. So you can go to uhhm.org to find out more information about the Universal Hip Hop Museum. But as for me, I want people to remember me as a guy who actually was a big part of practical study. So very important. Mm-hmm. Even in music, whatever it is that you want to do in life, I think that practical study is very important. You go and do your research in that field of whatever it is, doctor, lawyer, businessman, rapper, singer, DJ, doesn't matter. Study the history of it, and within that history, find out someone who was successful and study the steps that they took to achieve that success, and then repeat those steps. Mimic those steps, and then I guarantee you also will achieve success.
So do you think then, basically, since you were the first in so many situations, because I'm thinking, as you're speaking, I'm like, Curtis Blow is sitting next to us. He was the first person to get a major endorsement deal, right? Mm-hmm. In 2019, rappers are just blooming with endorsement deals. Basically, it seems like it should be a part of the education and matriculation as a, of an MC to have a Curtis Blow education since you were the first, right? I mean, there are other classes on other...
Well, I'm a big, avid supporter of education. Education, education is the key to success. It's the key to getting out of the ghetto. Research, you know, bring the classroom into the culture and the culture into the classroom. Very important, doing your research, like I said. And we as rappers, just speaking on rap, you know, the oratory... We are orators. We are communicators. So I majored in communications and studied the greatest orators of our time, like Barbara Jordan and Winston Churchill and Martin Luther King, Malcolm X. And I found out that we have all of these options and windows that we can open, doors that we can open as the orators of this culture. Like, for instance, public speaking, politics. You have broadcasting. You know, television and radio broadcasting, journalism. Here's one for you, preaching.
I forgot, you are Father Walker. You're ordained, correct?
Ordained minister. And and so, you know, in studying all of the great orators of our time, I found out that the most passionate of the speakers, the oratory, the orators, were the preachers and the reverends. You know, many of those speeches, like Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, you know, that gave me the fortitude and the will and the want to take it to the next level in this field. And as an MC, that means that you're a master of the ceremony. It doesn't matter what the ceremony is. You can be on the street corner in a circle full of 20 people. You can be at a club. You can be at a block party or park jam. You can be at a community center. You can be at a concert with 5 people or 20,000. You know, you can be at a bar mitzvah. You know, wherever it is.
Shut up, bar mitzvah.
Come on. I've played a couple of bar mitzvahs in my time. Yes, yes. And, you know, so that is the story. You are a master of any ceremony.
I don't know anybody who has used their communications degree to the levels that you have. In this moment, I just realized that. I was like, all my life, I think, as a communications major, I was like, maybe I should have did business or something like that. But now that you've broken it down like that.
No, you got some windows. You got some...
You're in communication. You're literally...
I am, but, you got to have some multiple hustles, as you know yourself as a former radio host. Just saying. Yes, yes, yes.
I just want to stay away from politics these days.
Nah, we need more people like you, you know, in front of the masses, you know. What can I say? Wait, I want to mention the Nutcracker.
Yeah, the Nut, please.
I totally forgot. I'm so caught in the history, I totally forgot. So, yeah, the Hip Hop Nutcracker. Explain to me this project, like how...
Wow. Well, the Hip Hop Nutcracker is a modernized version of the classic Tchaikovsky's incredible classical music. We are now... doing hip hop dance and break dancing and ballet and bringing the story to the masses with the culture of hip hop in the forefront. And so it's a new modernized version. Is really something that every family should see as during the holiday season. You know, when love is in the air and everyone's hugging on each other and trying to thank each other for putting up with you all year long.
Right.
You know, just go out and have a great time seeing this classic rendition of Tchaikovsky's hit. But
so like all the songs are filtered through hip hop, so there's like trap versions of the Sugar Plum song.
Ding, 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 ding. I might need to do that if it's not in there.
It's incredible because we have a DJ who is actually playing beats under this classical music.
Nice.
And we have an electric violinist who's doing their thing. But the creators of Jennifer Weber, I want to give her a shout out. She's also the choreographer and director.
Okay.
And Michael Fittison, put together this piece that is a great, great holiday family fun classic. So it's a show that everyone needs to see. All ages, all races. It doesn't matter.
It. Yeah.
It's incredible. It's really a good look for hip hop and a good look for music in general.
That's good. I mean, for you being on the forefront of one of the first hip hop ballets and I mean, you were there when hip hop was in stadiums with the Fresh Fest, and to go from there all the way to where we are now, that's quite a journey. We thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, I thank you for having me, you know, and a big shout out to all the dancers who are part of that, because we have so much talent that's out there, you know, these young dancers are coming out, you know, from all over the world, and they have so much mad flavor, so many different styles, from power moves to, you know, to the wave, to pop locking, you know, it's incredible to see how it's all put together and how Jennifer Weber did this thing. And the choreography is incredible.
Wow.
Well, thank you.
Yo, can I thank John and your wife, Shirley, too? Because this has been like a year and a half in the works.
I know.
To try
we've
to get
been
you here.
Yeah.
And like, thank you, Shirley. Thank you. Thank you.
So thank you,
Curtis, too.
Thank
you. You're welcome. Take a strong woman.
You get it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the crew, the Team Supreme, Unpaid Bill, Boss Bill, Sugar Steve, and Laia, this is Questlove. Thank you very much.
Whose bar mitzvah did you play?
Yo,
maybe I know them.
We are stopping right here. Yo, this is Questlove Supreme. We'll see you on the next go round. Thank you. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.